This is Free Speech Radio News for Tuesday, the 31st of October, 2006. From the studios of KPFK in LA, I'm Aura Bogado. Calls for a peaceful resolution to the conflict in Oaxaca expand beyond state lines to the international level. Philip Morris brings its case to the Supreme Court, seeking to overturn a nearly $80 million award for punitive damages. And after 15 years, the United States partially lifts its arms embargo on Haiti. We'll hear from Port-au-Prince. We'll bring you these stories and more after the headlines.
I'm Eric Klein with the headlines for Free Speech Radio News. Negotiations to end the nuclear crisis on the Korean Peninsula will soon resume. Jason Strother has more from Seoul.
The Chinese Foreign Ministry says that North Korea will return to the six-party talks. The announcement was made following a meeting today between negotiators from the U.S., China, and North Korea in Beijing. The talks aimed at persuading Pyongyang to stop its nuclear weapons program have been stalled for over a year. The nations participating in the rounds also include South Korea, Japan, and Russia. Tensions have risen in the region since the reclusive state test-fired a nuclear device on October 9th. The United Nations Security Council soon after imposed sanctions on Kim Jong-il's regime. Officials here in Seoul hope the resumption of talks will bring an end to the standoff. There's no word yet on when the new round of negotiations will get underway. For Free Speech Radio News in Seoul, South Korea, I'm Jason Strother.
Four Pakistani men have been acquitted of all charges in connection with a 2002 bomb blast near the American consulate in Karachi. An earlier trial at an anti-terrorism court had sentenced two of the accused to death. The other two were sentenced to life in prison. At today's acquittal, appeals judges reportedly said that the original trial was deeply flawed and ordered the men to be released if not wanted in other cases. Hundreds of thousands of shops across the Indian capital, Delhi, remained closed today as part of a three-day strike to protest the sealing of unauthorized commercial establishments. Vinod K. Jose reports.
India's highest court has ordered the government to demolish all properties which are illegally built. And when government started its demolition drive, thousands of traders hit the streets. The traders are on a three-day strike, calling the city government to stop sealing their shops. Demonstrators scuffled with the policemen as they tried to breach steel barricades to register their protest. Police fired tear gas and used water cannons to disperse the crowd. Last month, a one-day token strike ended up with chaos, killing four people in the violence. The capital's business community is expected to lose over 15 billion rupees, the equivalent of approximately $350 million due to their three-day shutdown. For FSRN from Delhi, this is Vinod K. Jules.
Rioting mobs rampaged through a northeastern Congo town yesterday, destroying 43 polling stations after a soldier killed two electoral workers in violence that came after Sunday's presidential runoff vote. Individual polling places began to post results, but the official overall outcome isn't expected for days. Free Speech Radio News' Joshua Chilimpa reports.
President Joseph Kabila faced ex-rebel leader Jean-Pierre Bemba in a runoff. Some 9,000 candidates also vied for 500 seats in the country's new parliament. Kabila enjoys enormous support in the east of the country, while Jean-Pierre Bemba has consolidated support from the west of the country. Both Kabila and Bemba have said they will accept the results even if they lose. But Bemba's camp has already complained of some irregularities. International observers have praised the election as well organized, despite some disruptions. Bemba supporters have alleged that the international community wants Mr. Kabila to win to protect European and American interests in the mineral-rich country. The vote has been run in the northeast town of Bumba, where polling stations were burnt amid fraud claims. At least one person died on the election day in the protest over the alleged fraud in the area. Joshua Chalimpa, FSRN, Kampala.
Just over a month since Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez's speech at the UN, and 1 week before this fall's congressional elections, the U.S. government is now investigating rumors of supposed links between the Venezuelan government and one of the largest and oldest voting machine manufacturers in the United States. Michael Fox has more from Caracas.
The U.S. investigation comes after months of rumors of a supposed link between Smartmatic and the Venezuelan government. Smartmatic is the privately owned Venezuelan parent company of Oakland-based Sequoia Voting Systems, whose equipment will be used in next week's congressional elections in more than 16 states. Both Venezuelan and Smartmatic officials have denied any Venezuelan state involvement in the company. Smartmatic and Sequoia announced on Sunday that the companies had filed voluntarily with the U.S. Committee on Foreign Investment in the United States to dispel any doubts that may exist regarding the independence of the company. Rumors to the contrary appear to be based on a Miami Herald article from 2004, which claimed that at one point the Venezuelan government was part owner of a software company in which two Smartmatic owners also held large shares. According to Sequoia, this part ownership was actually just collateral for a routine loan received from the Venezuelan government. Sequoia was the first voting machine manufacturer in the United States to implement voter verifiable paper audit trail technology during the 2004 presidential elections. Smartmatic acquired Sequoia in March of last year. This is Michael Fox, FSRN Caracas.
And I'm Eric Klein for Free Speech Radio News.
The Supreme Court heard a case that could better define the scope of punitive damages. The debate on the award given to people on no basis of tangible loss has been heard in U.S. courts for 200 years. Philip Morris brought their case before the High Court today, seeking to reverse a nearly $80 million punitive damage award handed down by an Oregon court. As Washington editor Leanne Caldwell reports, the case could impact the amount of damages a company would pay for their negligent behavior.
The case is Philip Morris USA versus Williams. In 1997, Jesse Williams died of lung cancer after 50 years of smoking Philip Morris cigarettes. Williams ignored the advice of his family and of news reports in the 90s that tobacco could kill. Before his death, Williams said, quote, "Those darn cigarette people finally did it. They were lying all this time." His widow, Mayola Williams, brought suit against Philip Morris on the basis that a public relations campaign deceived people into believing cigarettes were not unhealthy. Mayola Williams.
I've said it over and over again. It's to carry out justice wishes, to bring to the public's attention that the tobacco company was frauding peoples and deceiving them.
Two recent Supreme Court decisions set guidelines on punitive damages. The court's decision in this case could determine dollar limits and punitive awards by companies who could be sued for negligence. The Supreme Court is deciding if the Oregon Supreme Court rightfully awarded Mayola Williams $80 million in punitive damages, 97 times what her compensation was. Robert Peck represents Williams. He says the $80 million is not excessive. He based his argument on the reprehensibility of Philip Morris's actions, which is also the opinion of the Oregon Supreme Court.
I think what we have here is reprehensible conduct beyond any measure of anything any court has looked at, and that the size of the punitive damage award must reflect that.
But Philip Morris argued that $80 million is an excessive amount because the jury took into account not only Williams, but all people in Oregon who could get sick or die from smoking cigarettes. Philip Morris says their due process under the 14th Amendment is diminished, that they'll be unable to defend themselves in the future against such claims. Theodore J. Boutrous, Jr. is partner at the law firm of Gibson, Dunn & Crutcher in Los Angeles. He filed a friend of the court brief on behalf of product manufacturers.
I was very encouraged that the court focused on this notion that a jury should not be able to use a case involving one person to punish a company for allegations and claims regarding a bunch of other people who aren't in before the court. That's really a fundamental due process question, and it's an issue that comes up all the time in these product liability cases. So for the court to lay down some clear guidance in that regard, I think would be very helpful.
But Williams dismisses that argument, saying punitive damages must be large enough to act as a deterrence. This is a case dealing with big tobacco, but many big businesses are at the crux of the issue. Victor Swartz is general counsel to the American Tort Reform Association. He says if Williams wins this case, it could spur similar suits for other businesses.
It's very important for Merck cases, pharmaceutical cases, auto cases. It's not just about tobacco.
The courtroom was filled with interested parties. They include product manufacturers, pharmaceutical companies, insurance companies, automobile companies, major corporations who could be liable for harm or the death of a consumer. This case on punitive damages will be the first such case in a Roberts court, where he could be the swing vote. Roberts showed skepticism in the reasonableness of the $80 million award. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Leanne Caldwell.
Republicans are criticizing John Kerry for his comment yesterday before a student group where he told students to study hard or face getting stuck in Iraq.
You know, education, if you make the most of it and you study hard and you do your homework and you make an effort to be smart, you can do well. If you don't, you get stuck in Iraq.
Republicans are attacking Kerry's remarks with harsh criticism, and Kerry responded.
If anyone thinks that a veteran, someone like me who's been fighting my entire career to provide for veterans, to fight for their benefits, to help honor what their service is, if anybody thinks that a veteran would somehow criticize more than 140,000 troops serving in Iraq and not the president and his people who put them there, they're crazy. It's just wrong. This is a classic GOP textbook Republican campaign tactic. I'm sick and tired of a bunch of despicable Republicans who will not debate real policy, who won't take responsibility for their own mistakes, standing up and trying to make other people the butt of those mistakes. I'm sick and tired of a whole bunch of Republican attacks, the most of which come from people who never wore the uniform and never had the courage to stand up and go to war themselves. Enough is enough. We're not going to stand for this. This policy is broken. And this president and his administration didn't do their homework. They didn't study what would happen in Iraq. They didn't study and listen to the people who were the experts and would have told them. And they know that's what I was talking about yesterday.
With midterm elections just 7 days away, politicians on both sides are keeping their guards up. While Mexico's federal preventive police occupy key parts of downtown Oaxaca City, residents in outlying neighborhoods continue to put up barricades and otherwise maintain control of the majority of the metropolitan area. Meanwhile, calls for a peaceful resolution to the conflict in Oaxaca have expanded beyond state lines to the national and international level. Shannon Young reports.
Thousands of Oaxaca City residents marched yesterday afternoon to the city center from three different points to protest the presence of federal forces. When the march reached downtown, federal police launched tear gas and used water cannons against the protesters, who built barricades and set fire to vehicles. In response to the occupation of the central square, or Zócalo, some demonstrators set up an encampment on the esplanade of the Santo Domingo Church, a UNESCO World Heritage Site located some 5 blocks from the Zócalo. The Federal Preventative Police, or PFP, operation in Oaxaca City has so far left at least 2 dead, 80 detained, 60 disappeared, and around 100 wounded, according to local non-governmental organizations. Sara Mendez is a representative of the Oaxacan Human Rights Network.
In this operation, they used water cannon tanks that used a mixture of water with acid. They also used pepper spray, tear gas bombs, helicopters, small explosive devices, and bulldozers to remove barricades, etc.
President Vicente Fox says the federal police are in Oaxaca to, quote, recuperate social peace and tranquility. Although federal and state officials claim that daily life in Oaxaca will return to normal soon, there's little proof on the street to back up that assertion. Schools are still empty, businesses are closed, and public transportation has not operated for the past 5 days. In a new attack on members of the press, police detained Daniel Mota Figueroa, a reporter for local daily La Opinión, this morning near the airport. His exact whereabouts and legal situation are unknown. Media reports indicate that those detained by the PFP have been scattered in different jails, and that some are even being held in the local military base. Both houses of Mexico's Congress yesterday passed a resolution to ask Governor Ulises Ruiz to step down. Ruiz still refuses to leave office and has responded to the congressional resolution by saying he will launch a legal challenge with the Supreme Court. Striking teachers who have been camped out at Mexico's Senate building since last month welcomed the congressional resolution in a Mexico City press conference.
Consideramos que el pueblo de Oaxaca ha sido muy claro y que no cederemos en la demanda central.
We will consider that the people of Oaxaca have been very clear and that we will not renounce our central demand, which is the resignation and imprisonment of the assassin Ulises Ruiz. Until then, the teachers' wing of the Popular Assembly will not go back to classes.
Actions in solidarity with the popular movement in Oaxaca took place yesterday in front of Mexican consulates across the U.S. and in Vancouver, Paris, Frankfurt, and Naples. The leadership of the Zapatista Army of National Liberation issued a communique yesterday stating that rebels will close roads and highways tomorrow in the neighboring state of Chiapas. The Zapatista command is calling on sympathizers to take similar actions in other parts of Mexico and the United States. The rebel army has also announced a national strike on November 20th, the anniversary of the start of the Mexican Revolution. With Vladimir Flores, I'm Shannon Young in Oaxaca City.
Today marks the sixth anniversary of the adoption of the groundbreaking UN Security Council Resolution 1325 on women and armed conflict, which called for greater involvement of women in peacekeeping operations worldwide. But half a dozen years after its adoption, critics point out that peace support operations continue to be an area where women are still underrepresented at all levels, particularly at the top. FSRN's Danuta Zhifraniec reports from New York.
The Security Council urged the UN Secretary-General in its Resolution 1325 to appoint more women as special representatives and envoys to the conflict-ridden regions. It also called for the expansion of the role and contribution of women in the United Nations field-based operations, especially among military observers, civilian police, human rights, and humanitarian personnel. 6 years after that, statistics prove the opposite. As of August 2006, the overall representation of women on professional posts assigned to peace operations in civilian divisions was at 23.6%. As of September 2006, women made up only 4.5% of civilian police and 1.8% of military contingents in peacekeeping operations. Moreover, no UN peace operation is headed by a woman special representative, and only one, the UN Assistance Mission in Afghanistan, has a woman serving as a deputy special representative. One of the countries where this resolution is of particular importance is Burma, which has been ruled by a series of military regimes since 1962. Ying Lao is a refugee and a representative of the Women's League of Burma, an umbrella organization comprising 12 women's organizations from that country. After escaping the oppression in her homeland, she joined the Shan Women's Action Network in order to provide assistance for other women.
I believe that without the inclusion of women in political processes and public leadership roles, there will not be democracy or equality in our society or in Burma. Therefore, through my work as a young women advocate, I am committed to work hard to convince our male counterparts in the movement. I strongly believe that using UN Security Council 1325 will empower women and increase women participation in the struggle for peace and political change in Burma and Burma Democracy Movement.
War in Uganda has once been described by Ian Egeland, UN Undersecretary for Humanitarian Affairs, as the worst forgotten crisis in the world, with 85% of the country's fighters being children. Betty Bigombe is a former Ugandan government minister named Woman of the Year in her country in 1993. She claims that although Ugandan women have moved from victimhood to the promoters of peace, they still need support and help, which the UN resolution can provide.
That energy, that strength is there. The world is lacking us. That after this resolution 1325, finally the UN is giving us this platform, is trying to support our women in every way.
Critics of the resolution claim, however, that it has no teeth. In order to change that, it should be treated as a binding international law, which takes precedence over domestic law or policy. Janet Benshoof, the president of the Global Justice Center in New York, shares that view.
There's a big limitation to the enforcement of this resolution because it has been largely left to UNIFEM and UNFPA, which are UN agencies. The problem is these agencies work with countries. Countries that are so bad that the entire democracy movement is outside the country are not part of the 1325 UNIFEM training or the UNIFEM violence against women money. So there's none of that goes to these Burmese women. They don't have any access to the UN agency to effectuate 1325.
Many also argue that the pattern of exclusion of women from their advancement in peacekeeping has been reinforced by widespread sexual violence, intimidation, and threats against women. Sally Mary is a professor of anthropology and law and society at New York University. She has just published a book looking at human rights and gender violence, where she calls for more protection mechanisms of women in peacebuilding.
We all know that there are a great deal of difficulty that women face in coming forward and acknowledging that they have been raped in situations of conflict. This may mean that their reputations are ruined, they will never be able to marry, they will never be able to be a respected member of society, and therefore real difficulties in even getting women to speak because of the stigma attached. and yet we know this is a very widespread process.
Experts agree, though, that Resolution 1325 indicates a growing realization that in conflict situations, women are more than victims requiring the protection of the international community. They are negotiators, peacemakers, and advisors whose efforts are vital to sustainable peace. Just as Haris Silajic, the president of Bosnia and Herzegovina, once put it, if we'd had more women around the table, there would have been no war. Women think long and hard before they send their children to kill other people's children. I'm Danuta Franjec, Free Speech Radio News, New York.
Nigeria's anti-corruption body says that more than $380 billion has been either stolen or wasted in the country since independence in 1960. The bulk of the money is from oil proceeds. While critics maintain that billions of dollars earned yearly from oil sales only benefit Western oil companies and Nigeria's corrupt ruling class, local communities in the oil-bearing Niger Delta region remain desperately poor. The communities say this inequality is partially responsible for the insurgency against Western oil companies operating in the region. FSRN's Sam Olokoya reports from Lagos.
Nigeria is the world's sixth largest oil exporter, but Nuhu Ribadu, head of Nigeria's anti-corruption agency, says due to corruption, Nigeria has nothing to show for its huge oil resources.
We believe corruption is responsible for almost all our failures, our incompetence, our mismanagement. Nigeria is probably one of the worst in terms of, the biggest victim of corruption in the world. It's a country that has been denied everything. It's a country that is well endowed, very rich both in natural and human resources, but nothing much to show as a result of corruption.
The Niger Delta region, where Nigeria earns more than 90% of its income through oil exploitation, is ironically one of the poorest parts of Nigeria. The people lack access to the oil revenue taken from their land. Besides, they have been made poorer by frequent oil spills caused by Western oil companies operating in the region. Victoria Oriri is from Ukokolo village.
Every cassava when you plant for ground, then petrol.
The crops and fishes we rely on for our livelihood have all been killed by oil pollution. Our drinking water has been polluted. We lack food. My child is out of school because I am too poor to pay for his school fees.
Now my pikin when they go school, no get money, no get work, no when they work, now they go school again.
Armed youths known as the Niger Delta Freedom Fighters sing in Port Harcourt, the largest city in the Niger Delta. The region has in the last month seen a growing insurgency. Boma George says he and other youths took up arms against Western oil companies to compel them to give a share of oil revenue to local communities.
I came out from a college. I made all my papers. There was no job. Then I decided to join the struggle. And as I entered the struggle, it's a militant organization. So I decided to say, if it is arms, I will carry to defend my land, to fight, to make sure that we achieve our goal. That is to say, resource control and self-determination.
In the last month, local militants have kidnapped more than 40 foreign oil workers and attacked several oil installations. The growing violence has forced Nigeria to reduce its oil exports by a quarter. But the Nigerian government and the Western oil companies have so far not shown any desire to give local communities a share of oil revenue. For Free Speech Radio News, this is Sam Olukoya in Lagos.
It's Brother Cornell West. I'm just hoping and praying that you have the good enough sense to always tune in to Free Speech Radio News. Lays bare the truth and inspires you to fight for justice.
The U.S. government announced the partial lifting of its 15-year arms embargo on Haiti this month, which was intended to quell the violence that followed the 1991 coup d'etat of former President Jean-Bertrand Aristide. But current leader René Préval claims it was preventing the Haitian police from obtaining the firepower they needed to combat armed gangs. Katie Sossin reports from Port-au-Prince, Haiti.
Haitian President René Préval has praised the partial lifting of the embargo as essential to bolstering Haiti's under-equipped and outgunned police force. He defends the lifting of the embargo as a step in the right direction and insists it will be accompanied by a plan to reform Haiti's notoriously corrupt police force. But some critics argue that it will do little to stop a rash of kidnappings and ongoing gang violence. Yolette Etienne is the representative of Oxfam in Haiti. She fears an influx of more guns could actually lead to even more crime and human rights violations.
Mais en même temps, on connaît que la police a lui-même les besoins de restructuration, les besoins d'épuration et
we know that the police institution needs to be reconstructed and restaffed, and we don't really have the mechanisms right now to control the arms in this institution. In these conditions, we don't think that the lifting is a positive thing, even though logically the government is supposed to supply the means to protect the civil population. So the first step we are supposed to take is not towards buying more arms, but towards trying to have more mechanisms to control the proliferation of arms inside the country.
With the lifting of the embargo, the government will be able to purchase firearms, body armor, and other equipment for the police. But individuals, companies, and private groups will still be prohibited from importing weapons from the United States. There are an estimated 200,000 small arms in Haiti already. Haiti has no arms industry, and most weapons have been smuggled illegally from the United States and other countries. The lifting of the embargo would only affect arms legally imported from the United States. Patrick A. Lee is Haiti's former Secretary of Defense and anti-narcotics chief.
Our problems of national security are of two kinds. One that really revolves about the socio-political situation and has nothing to do with the kind of ordinance that the police carries. You know, you're not going to stop kidnapping any better with a bazooka that you're going to do with a 38 revolver. And one that revolves around the fact that we do not control our borders, that we have, in fact, lost our sovereignty. And that's a more complex situation than can be resolved by simply lifting a so-called arm embargo.
The move to partially lift the embargo represents a vote of confidence in Préval, who was elected by a wide margin last February. The United States had previously denied a request from former President Jean-Bertrand Aristide to remove the embargo as his enfeebled police force succumbed to an armed rebellion. The U.S. government similarly refused to lift the embargo during the interim government that succeeded Aristide, although it gave the Haitian police weapons anyway, in case-by-case exceptions to the measure. For Free Speech Radio News, this is Katie Sasson, Port-au-Prince, Haiti.
You've been listening to Free Speech Radio News, an independent, listener-supported newscast produced by Simba Russo and Monica Lopez. Our Washington editor is Leanne Caldwell. Shannon Young is our headlines editor. Our technical production team at KPFA in Berkeley includes Eric Klein and Antonio Ortiz. You can listen to this newscast in its entirety online at www.fsrn.org. That's fsrn.org. We welcome your comments, questions, and story ideas. Just email us at comments@fsrn.org. From KPFK in Los Angeles, I'm Aura Bogado.